Badgers, welcome to season two of our podcast. I'm Sam Cooper.
Sam, can we get a bit more upbeat?
Okay.
Season two. This is a big deal.
Well, you do it, Badger. Come on, get the dust.
Welcome back, Badgers. Season two of the Golf Badgers podcast with me, James Bledge, and your main host.
Hello, I'm Sam Cooper.
That's better, isn't it?
I don't know. I think it's...
that'll end up being edited out.
Yeah, that's... Let's start as we mean to go on. We've been off the airwaves for a long time now, since July, I think.
Busy boys,
but the winter is here, the nights are dark, and Bledge and I have time to spend nattering away into a microphone, and hopefully you're doing a few more of these podcasts that you've been asking for, because we have, Bledge, haven't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been some great feedback from everyone that's been listening, and we thought we'd just start up a catch-up, because it has been a while, and then we will go into guests after this. And one of the kind of things that we wanted to get from you guys was maybe some ideas of guests that you would like to hear from. Is that right?
Absolutely. And we found, basically, that over the winter, over the... late autumn, early spring, the nights, the nature of how we both work. I work as an architect, Bledge, obviously, course manager here down at Hoylake, Royal Liverpool. We probably have a little bit more time in the evenings to do these. Over the summer, I'm travelling a lot. Bledge is, well, particularly busy last year for obvious reasons, or this year for obvious reasons. But taking it as a season two, a fresh start, getting a great lineup of guests, and we're excited about some of the people that are going to join us this over the next few months. But as Bledge says, what do you want out of the podcast? You are the listeners, and that's who we're here for. So if you've got any suggestions of people you'd like to hear from in and around the industry, doesn't have to just be greenkeeping or architecture. They could be agronomists or irrigation or drainage or ecology, any of the things that are in and around the golfing industry, then we would love to bring those people to you. So please do get in touch with me. I'm Links from the Road on Instagram, or at SD Cooper on Twitter, or X as it now is. And Bledge, how can people get in touch with you?
On Twitter, I refuse to call it the other one. I am at James Bledge, BLEDGE. But do we not? We have a Golf Badgers page, do we not?
We have a little Instagram page that, again, has been as neglected as the podcast, but we can revive it. So that's another one, at Golf Badgers on Instagram.
I mean, I think we did 21 episodes last year, in our first year, so that's not too bad. That's pretty good. It's more than I thought we would have done, so well done to you.
Well, with all things considered, Bledge, I mean, the Open Championship was kind of a big thing to...
It delivered us with a lot of content.
Well, that is true. And we've still got plenty to unpick from it.
Now everyone doesn't have to listen to me rabbit on about the Open anymore, and we could actually ban it if you wanted.
Tempting.
And look forward to speaking to some other guys. But moving on, Samuel, what have been your main focus of work recently?
I've had an interesting few months, really, Bledge. So... obviously, I'm the main sort of associate here in Britain with CDP, so I work with my colleagues mainly with Frank Pont, but also Mike Clayton and Mike DeVries, and collectively we've got quite a bit going on here. We've got some pretty exciting projects. I actually took a step back a couple of months ago, looked at the work we have, and they're all projects with great potential. You know, we've been very fortunate. We don't really have places that, you know, are fine and could only ever be fine or a little bit better than fine. We have places that are good that could end up being absolutely great. Mm-hmm. So we're in a fortunate position now where we can be quite, you know, selective is the wrong word, but, you know, at the end of the day, there are only so many hours out there. We want to be doing the podcast, and I need to get the balance right of everything else. So we've got to make sure that we're doing really, really meaningful stuff. And we're very fortunate that that is the case so far. So we've got some great projects. It's been taking me up to Scotland quite a bit. But beyond that, I've been working on and writing what will be a sort of 18 part, very self-indulgent, but a book series, which is going to be my Links from the Road travel, when I played 225 links courses in just over a couple of years, living out of a van. So that was my sort of my starting point in architecture, really, or on a proper level. So I've been writing up that volume one is coming out in the springtime in Britain,
which is entitled.
Well, it's just volume one of my Links from the Road tour. You know,
is it not Hoylake to Hesketh?
Well, Hoylake to Hesketh. So that's right. We're going clockwise around the country. So course number one, start where I know best, starting here. And then there's a dozen courses featured. There's an essay on each one, some longer than others, but each one gets equal billing. That was important to me because I didn't, you know, there's so much written about Hoylake and Birkdale. And of course, there's more to write about those places. But I also wanted to write just as much or give equal billing at least to the small courses that mm-hmm. no one's heard of, but are no less important to the people who actually play their golf there. Mm-hmm. So that will be the case all the way through. And then there's sort of an essay on what Links Golf is and memories and anecdotes from each leg of the tour as we go round. So I'm very excited about that.
You'll be in Waterstones signing it.
Maybe toppings of St Andrews or something, but I think Waterstones is definitely too mainstream for me there. But the other part of that is that's coming out, as I say, springtime for volume one, a quarterly thing thereafter. But Aquatrols have kindly supported me on the project as well. So if you're, I know many people listening out there will be Aquatrols customers.
Other wetting agents are available.
Other wetting agents are available. But those guys have been very kind to me and they're supporting it. So you might expect, or you might find Christmas time, or if you're along at BTME or the golf show in Phoenix, you'll get an early advance copy, slightly different version, but the same content through it. So you might get a sneak peek of one of those.
That's pretty cool.
Through your letterbox.
I'm looking forward to seeing that. It's a great little thing to.
I'm quite proud of it. It took a long time, and it'll get a lot easier now that we've actually got the concept nailed down.
Well, you're a wordsmith, Sam. So it'll be.
Not sure about that, but got some nice photographs. Got some nice places that we went to. So I thought it would be a shame if they just stayed on the hard drive and never saw the light of day. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to get it out there.
No, it's good. Well, it's what you love doing. You love writing. You're a great writer. So that'll be
very kind. Well, Bledge, less about me. What have you been up to since the Open rolled out of
well,
town?
I felt great since the Open. You know, we've cracked on with a lot of good work in the course. We've been working hard, cutting all the rough down and resetting the place, trying to restitute it. She's come back well, but we have had, the same as everyone else in the country, the worst weather possible. I mean, I think we're almost hitting a metre of rainfall, which
it's been unbelievable,
it's a lot
hasn't
more.
It?
It's a lot more, yeah. I think you usually would finish up here about 700 mil or something like that, maybe a bit less, but we're touching a metre now. It's relentless as you look outside just now. I mean, last night I was driving Santa's sleigh. If anyone wants some funny pictures, have a look on the Instagram, the club's Instagram. Driving Santa through the course in 85 mile an hour gusts. Ended up having to find his hat that had blown off in one of the bunkers as the elves were frantically falling about in the back of the trailer that our mechanic Phil had spent days decorating. So, it's that's been good. I think that's been a really cool thing to do. And apparently there were owls in the clubhouse last night. There were barn owls that I never seen.
I think that's a side to Hoylake that not that many people realise exists. Mm-hmm. It is a local members club, mm-hmm. despite the status, the quality of the course, the magnificence of the clubhouse, the history and all of the other things that it is well known for. I always try and make that point that first and foremost, it's a local members club where, you know, you bring your kids down to,
to meet fun.
One of the members dressed up as Santa. Or
no, that was Santa
himself.
Santa.
Yeah, of course.
Well, there was an actual change in Santa this year because last year's Santa had a bit too much to drink.
Oh no, there's a new Santa.
Yeah, it was. So it was John, the assistant clubhouse manager, after Joe got sacked last year. So I seen Joe in the Chinese last night and showed him the pictures, and he took it quite well.
Did he?
Yeah,
okay.
He was good.
He didn't take it personally.
Fair days, yeah. But that's what Santas are supposed to get hammered before they go out in the sleigh, are they not?
I don't know how you could do it any other way.
Yeah, well, there's actually a really, really funny photo of him looking proper cheesed off as he's getting blown about in the back. But yeah, it was great last night. Our two kids were up there, causing a riot. And, you know, they just clear out the club room, which is our nicest room, and they're banging on the windows. You know, they turn all the lights off, and I'm going down Stanley Road, and the big John Deere tractor with all the lights on. And it was just hilarious. It was really cool. So I love doing that kind of, I mean, as much as kids burst me, I love doing stuff like that. You know, like, the, we also, I mean, going in the kind of, we'll talk a bit more about the kind of public speaking I've been doing recently, but the, I did a talk at West Kirby Primary School after Jen's first green event down at the Chipping Green, the week after that, and it was the most enjoyable talk I've ever delivered. 50 kids, wild, putting their hands up for everything. Loads of questions, sir, sir. And I thought, how rewarding is that, you know, if you can do that? Just brilliant. And last night was kind of the same.
Well, hopefully one of those kids or a few of those kids might now think greenkeeping's a viable career option for them, because surely the industry needs that, and that's the first green initiative.
Well,
in nutshell,
definitely.
Isn't it?
We need to get Jen on the podcast, talk about it. That was a pilot event, you know, for, we're trying it on the youngest kids, bigger and first green. And now that they know how that works, they can take it to kids that are actually about to leave school. And then we've done career fairs, but this is, we have an absolute crisis in our industry of people applying for jobs. Kids don't know about greenkeeping, they don't know about it. So the whole point of this first green is make them aware of it, raising the awareness, and it will work. It's got to work, you know, and we need to do it. We just can't sit on our backsides and just complain about it. And the fact that Bigger have taken this first green initiative on from the GCSAA is brilliant. And I can't think, I'm not being biased, but I can't think of anyone better, you know, what Jen's like to do it than Jen. You know, she's
perfect person.
Absolutely. So proactive about stuff like that. And she's done a great job so far. She's been doing public speaking. She's done Somerset Cricket Club, Wentworth, you know, and the Scottish Conference. And that's very intimidating, you know, to stand up having never, ever talked in front of a crowd before, to stand up in front of 150 guys.
No, good for her. We'll, yeah, absolutely. Jen will be one of the guests on the pod this coming series, so looking forward to talking to her.
We can't have any alcohol involved, though, when she's on talking, because, I mean, she was...
Well, we're clean living on the podcast this year. We've gone from being sponsored by Brewdog and whoever else to a
You've got
to
a lovely
coffee.
Little cafe au lait, and I've got a mocha this morning with some toast, but it's Sunday morning. It's Sunday morning, yeah, we will bring the booze back. But yeah, that's been kind of been what I've been up to, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the courses you've been working on. That'll kind of, I guess, will link into some of the work that we've been doing here. So,
well, before we do, I'd like to ask you. You know, you mentioned about cutting all the rough down and the work that you've been doing this winter period at Hoylake. So, I think that's interesting in itself. Something that I'm quite passionate about. Yeah. Like, I'll give you a bit of background on this. So, I've been campaigning for a bit of rough management for a long time, long before you started here, Bledge. I used to be on the Green Committee a long time ago here, before I got involved in the industry. And it's something that I was quite passionate about. The playing surfaces, the fairways, the tees, the greens at Hoylake have always been amazing. Amazing, as good as anywhere that I've ever been. But, you know, the rough is somewhere that I find quite a lot. We've got pretty narrow fairways here, because it's a championship setup, it's a championship test at the end of the day. And I know, you know, the old Harry Colt line, narrow fairways made bordered by long grass makes for miserable golfers, and it's striking that balance between playability and challenge is always a tricky thing. But now the Open Championship has been and gone, what have you been doing to try and restore that balance and get a playable, not just the cut grass, but the wider playing areas of Hoylake, which we inevitably find as amateur golfers? We find the rough. So what are you doing, and how do you go about trying to create a surface that means you can find a golf ball and still have a challenge when you do so?
Mm-hmm. Well, I play a bit of golf, as you know, and I kind of agree with the Harry Colt saying to an extent. I always also believe that you should be able to play a round of golf without losing a golf ball, unless you hit an absolutely wild one, you know. We've been working hard with our ecologist, Bob Taylor, working on exactly how much rough to cut. So we cut everything pretty much wall to wall, because outside we would have your 2-inch, your 4-inch, your 8 metres of fringing bearing, the lope line was kind of coming back anyway. So we just cut the whole lot, reset it. And then what we've done then after that is just cut that eight metres again of the fringing rough with a scarifying blade, really rip into it. So there's a couple of wee scalped bits out there, as you'd notice, but it's fine. Come back, seed bed's been there for 100 plus years. After having a really wet winter, autumn winter as we've had just now, if we were not to touch that rough come next spring, summer, it would be absolutely brutal. And we don't want that. We want people to keep going, keep playing their golf, not having to look for balls all the time. If you have one person in a group of four looking for a ball, it's long enough. Imagine having four, you know. So it looks better. It's better for ecology, you know. And then outside that, then you can have the really, really thick rough, which is better for field mice.
So when we talk about rough, can we get a bit nerdy and a bit specific on what we're actually mean? Because I think most people just think long grass is long grass, and of course there's more to it than that. There's one of the best examples that I've seen of rough across a site was actually at Skibo, and Chippy up at Skibo ran into Chippy the other day, and I was saying, you know, I think when I've played at Skibo, and I've been lucky enough to go a few times, invariably you miss a fairway there, the rough looks like it's up to your bloody
but you can see through it.
But you can see where your ball is from 20 yards away. So you walk straight to it, you're not looking for a ball, and then you stand over your shot. And I think it's a skill that you can develop as a golfer. You look at your lie, you look at the rough around it. Is it going to jump? Am I going to have to take less club because I'm going to get a flyer? Am I going to be able to get, maybe I can get a 7-iron to that, or if I open the face, I can get a 7-iron. But if I try to hit a 6-iron, it's just going to turn over, not come out, and compound the error. So for me, I think that's entirely the challenge. And it's not about just having no rough. It's about having the right kind of rough. So what kind of grasses are you trying to get rid of through this process? And what do you want to see in the end?
So, the Skibo were one of the first lot to really start in the glory days of the chemical use when we had Pinoxidin, i.e. Rescue. These were in the days when I worked at King's Barn, so that would be 15 plus years ago. So, constant cutting, collecting, pulling the nutrients out, not dropping any material that refeeds the rough, feeds the grasses that are ranker, your obvious ones, your Yorkshire Fog and your ryegrass, you know. And I mean, fescue can get really, really thick if it's not treated properly. But essentially up at Skibo, they've pretty much got pure fescue roughs as far as I know.
That's a good point, because I think I'm going to mention Ballybunion as an example of that, where I think they overseed with fescue a lot, a hell of a lot. And I noticed when I was there once, you can end up in places, and they do a great job of maintaining the site, of course, but the certain places where perhaps you end up with almost this really, really dense little strip
matted
of fescue that you definitely couldn't see a ball in, but it's fescue, but it's so dense. Has that come about from overseeding a lot? And
I mean, if West Coast Ireland, it could just be,
and it's wet,
moisture, yeah, and good warm growing conditions in the summer. It could be areas in that golf course, it's just there's maybe more topsoil where there's more nutrient and water held in it, so it's more productive. But I mean, fescue still needs controlled. If we had pure fescue roughs out here, you still need to cut and collect it, rake it, scarify it, burst into it. And by doing that as well, you kind of you leave yourself more open for, yeah, you'll have weeds come through, but you'll also have a lot potentially wildflowers, or you can re-sow wildflowers in.
Yeah, beautiful.
Which we've done quite a bit here. We kind of took advantage of having broken ground after the Open. I mean, working with our members, Barbara Farmer, who's written some books here on wildflowers, and we've been getting some good mixes that we actually got off the ICL Syngenta Turf Rewards points, you know, for buying a certain amount of fertiliser or wetting agent, you get the rewards. So we put that back into buying wildflower mix. So we're looking, that'll take quite a while to come through, but it looked really nice when it's through, and it'll add a kind of another mosaic to the course. But it's not a silver bullet, this cutting and collecting. It takes years. I mean, we did it at Deal when we arrived at Deal, myself, Chris Bernard, Chris is now at Littlestone. The first year we did it, a lot of the members were kind of shocked, you know, and we cut, collect, sprayed. Now we're in the glory days, as we said, and now we don't have that.
That's not an option anymore.
I'm afraid not, but that was the golden bullet, the silver bullet, you know, because it did kill the rescue, did kill the bad stuff. It's essentially what we call a graminicide, which is a herbicide that kills grass.
Selectively.
That's good,
Jinx.
Isn't it? Jinx. So what we've been hammering it here, and the course looks pretty barren just now, but we're getting a lot of good feedback from the members.
Who cares?
They're really happy because they're thinking
winter.
About the long run.
But exactly. If I think it's something that I find on my day-to-day architecture hat on, if you want to make a change and it's for the sake of making a change, you should never do it. Never ever do it. These courses have been around for a long time. I'm very passionate. If you only end up about the same as where you start, why are you bothering in the first place? But if it's going to make a big change and it makes a big impact in the long run, and people can understand why you are proposing something, or that could be a change to the course or a body of work, a maintenance practice that you haven't always done. If you can communicate effectively the why you're trying to do it, I liken it to, you know, no one wants to go to the dentist, but if you've got a toothache and you know that going to the dentist means that by the time you've done that, you're not going to have toothache anymore, then you go, don't you? You tolerate a degree of short-term pain because you know that it's so worth it in the long run. And if at the same time, you know, winter golf, you just want to be round as quickly as possible.
I think so. And I don't think you can ever make this golf course easy. It's not only that, you know, we've been controlling the gorse out there as well. A lot of the gorse has got quite leggy. You need to be brutal with gorse, and we've been cutting literally 6-7 foot stands.
Fixer, isn't it? So that's only
exactly,
going to...
Yeah. I mean, it's 7 foot stands down to ankle height, and then it literally comes back by next May. It'll be back bushy again.
That's something I find interesting as well, in that when it comes back, it will have a very different character to the stuff that you've got rid of, won't it?
Definitely. It looks completely...
Is it right, the European gorse, you know, if it's come back and it's low and you cut it and you keep it, like, it will be a bit softer and springier?
So it's less leggy, bushier, which is essentially, it's better for nesting birds as well, because they've got more areas to hide. And yeah, you still need the odd leggier tall, but because you want your calling mating birds to stand on top of that and shout themselves a bird, another bird.
That's interesting.
That's exactly true, you know. So we, again, working with Bob Taylor on that, making sure we're doing everything right. We're going to try and take down half of the gorse we've got this year, which is quite severe. But then it'll be back up by May, June, and then the next year we take the other half, and then we can reset and just start hedge trimming it after that instead of chainsawing it all down.
Because I think that's entirely it, isn't it? The fact that it comes back.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that people can look across the site and go, oh, Christ, you know, where's all the rough gone? Where's the gorse gone? And before you know it, blink and you miss it, it's back.
It's back, yeah. And the rough will still come back thick next year. It's going to be a journey, but it's kind of liking it to, if anyone... I mean, you do get the odd member that kind of questions it, but it's like saying you wouldn't clean cobwebs from your living room. You know, you still got to keep it clean. Cobwebs, it's natural for the spiders to get in and start making their house there, or making it untidy, like the gorse, and when the rough gets long. But you've got to clean it, you know. You've got to stand in the way of natural progression sometimes. We've got loads of trees that are starting to grow out in the estuary. You know,
that's it. I think... If you leave any site long enough, be it a heathland site, a parkland site that by probably definition has been cleared of trees at some point historically to create an environment for golf to thrive and survive, or even a lynx site, if you leave it unmanaged for long enough, if you prevent, you know, the natural fires that might have come across a heathland site because it's maintained to a degree, and you stop that cycle of a site regenerating through that process, you will end up with probably a deciduous woodlands across that size anyway, weren't you, if you leave it long enough?
You can't let nature take its course a lot of the time, because you're actually causing more harm to a lot of the kind of rarer species. I mean, you look at our natterjack toads, for example. We're cutting some trees down in the estuary that all the foliage would be an adequate place for the common toads to hang out. Where all the leaves are falling off the trees, and so then they're actually a big threat to the natterjacks. Natterjacks are rare, the commons are not. So there's other places where they can live. You know, the common toads are meant to be elsewhere, where the natterjacks are meant to be there. You know, they can't go anywhere else.
So many knock-on effects that, you know, we've inadvertently caused, aren't there? I wrote in my piece on Formby, touched on the red squirrels that they have up at Formby. One of very few places, I think only two or three sites in England that have them.
And Scotland Grant, Frogley at Ladybank's seen some.
Well,
he's been working with
that's because the site they, or the part of the country they exist most readily is the Cairngorms, and he's obviously on the edge of the southern edge of that kind of area. But if you were to go, so it's great they're sort of coming further south, but the further north you go, it's just clear that I think the research is, it's just to illustrate the inadvertent thing. So grey squirrel brought over in the Victorian era, let loose, I think it was in Woburn or somewhere, and then just completely outcompetes the red squirrel. It's bigger, it's hardier.
Do they eat their red squirrels?
Well, I think they carry a disease that they are immune to that the red squirrels aren't.
Oh, that's cheeky.
And one of the big controllers are pine martens. So pine martens, and there are lots of them up in the sort of Cairngorms in that northern area, they will, the red squirrels will hide because they are wary by sort of nature, whereas the grey squirrels don't. So the pine martens actually end up controlling the grey squirrel population. And it's all basically, the point I'm trying to make is, you have changed the environments that allow the pine martens to survive, but in exactly the way you're talking about. Pine martens need pine trees and heather and those and landscapes that you think about up there. If it was deciduous, well, then there'll be other things that come with that that then hunt the pine martens, and the pine martens then can't control the grey squirrels, and this species that was brought in from America, I think, then ends up just completely getting rid of something that now needs protecting and needs the help. And the onus is on golf. You know, the knock-on thing when you look in the media and it's always, oh, golf courses should be parks or fields or whatever the bollocks they're talking about. Golf can play a massive role in managing effectively thousands upon thousands of acres of land in a way that couldn't ordinarily be maintained in the way it should be.
Well, we spend a lot of time, not just on the golf course, but on our estuary. So everything up to the high tide line, managing that. I mean, we've got a hectare worth of reed land to cut this year and burn. I've got a load of invasive species along the dunes that I need to take a digger along and dig out. I need to scrape out the natterjack ponds. So there's a hell of a lot of work with all the trees to come down there as well. And just like little sapling trees, you know, but in 5-10 years' time, they're going to be huge. Yeah. Some of them are behind our members 11th, which is open 13. If you look on the left there now, the trees actually got so big that they're covering the islands. So you can't even see the islands, you know. So it just shows you we need to act now. And I mean, like Southern Ness is a perfect example of this. I remember down at Southern Ness, CDP are doing the work down there as well. You play out the 11th hole, you look to the right-hand side, you can hardly no longer see the sea because of all these bloody trees that are growing there. And it's just a crying shame. It really is. You need to deal with that.
It's one of the most beautiful views as well, isn't it? You know, it's not often you
Yeah, it's one of the best views in Scotland.
Well, exactly. You're looking back at England, so it's just stunning. And
maybe we should grow the trees up.
But it's disappearing.
It's not meant to be there, though.
No.
You know, that's the thing. It's a dunescape, you know. It's just, we're going to pull all our gorse out from the sand scrapes on top of the dunes, the left of 12 this year, because it's getting more and more evasive and covering the dunes up, you know. So we need open sand there, if anything. So, yeah, we work hard with Cheshire Wildlife Environment Agency, stuff like that. So, but we've...
Well,
we do everything right.
The just to circle back very quickly before we move on to the vegetation management, the gorse clearance, all that kind of stuff. I remember when I first talked to, I think it was David Thompson at Skibo a few years ago, and I was asking him on that subject of managing the rough, cutting and collecting it, all that kind of stuff. He said the first year they baled it, because they actually bale the rough twice a year, take it away. The first year they did that, I think he said they took 100, they had 180 bales. And now when they do it, because they still do it, even though it's magnificent, that's why they keep doing it. Now, when they do it, they have something like 60 bales.
Yes, aye. Because it'll be getting thinner and thinner.
And doesn't that just, it's the same area of
land. I mean, that just shows that it's working.
But there's one third the amount of grass mm-hmm. on it.
Yeah, I mean, we've taken a lot off this year, and to the point where our compost heap is absolutely overspilling. You need to pull all that out and mix it up and turn it over and rotate it. And then, I mean, in years to come, that'll be good compost material, you know, for mixed with soil, with divot mix, etc. So it's all recyclable material, but so it'll get less and less.
Stripping the nutrients
it's
out of the soil, mm-hmm. old nitrogen cycle, breaking that, and reversing it almost.
Mm-hmm.
What have you used to actually do it, Bledge? Do you have a...
So we have a Wiedemann Super 500, which is nice, but my friend Steve Carmichael at Amazon... demoed us a Profi Hopper 1500. It was brilliant. It was really good.
Was it?
Really good. That's done the fringe and rough. So you can see, I mean, it's scarified it out. So it's on Santa's shopping list.
So what does that cut and scarify and collect?
It's a self-propelled Super 500, essentially. But you just change the blades in seconds. So it's actually ripping out the thatch and the moss as well at the same time and creating space for new growth. Essentially, I put some good pictures on Twitter if anyone's interested.
Well, it's looking lean and clean out there at the moment.
And it's still a difficult golf course. I challenge anyone to ever think this place is easy. When you can hit it everywhere, it's still difficult.
Well, okay,
it's completely playable now though.
I'm gonna throw in the architecture of thing, because obviously that's what I always come back to. I sometimes hear from clients, from golfers, from whoever, the way that we make this course tough is grow the rough up. And in fact, with the rollback debate going on at the moment, which we probably shouldn't touch on, I'm sure it's been covered to death elsewhere.
So I've got six dozen Pro Vs sitting there.
You'll use them in time, but
I'll probably have them used by the end of next year, never mind 2028.
But, you know, you still see this completely... I won't be drawn on it, but the old debate of, just grow the rough up, make the fairways narrower. And it's like, well, how does that challenge the best player and also allow the average golfer to play? It's just stupid. But it is something that's so often heard. And I always come back to the point, you should be able to have a difficult golf course that challenges the best players, but everyone can play it, with no long grass on the entire site. You shouldn't do that, obviously. That's then unsustainable to manage. But really, if it's not a difficult golf course with the entire, let's say it's 150 acres, if you couldn't cut 150 acres at fairway height and the golf course still be difficult, then architecturally, it's not right. That's my fundamental belief. And then, of course, you do have rough, you do have all of the different lengths of cut that you would expect. You have the bunkering. But realistically, a golf course should never rely on its rough for its challenge. It should always be the angles and the where you're trying to go and the bunkering and the runoffs and the architecture. Rough, if anything, is a sticking plaster to try and fix a problem that really is you're not addressing the cause of. You're only ever addressing the symptom if you rely on rough to make a golf hole difficult, in my opinion.
I spend plenty of time in it. I know plenty about it. But well, it's for likes of Hoylake, though, I mean, it'd be interesting. We look back, we pull the Google Earth slider right back into as far back as we can, and the fairways probably have shrunk quite a bit, but it's...
25% narrower than they were 20 years ago.
Had you redesigned this now, the amount of extra irrigation, cutting everything, just would be absolutely rocketed. I think it's probably a case of probably finding a balance between it, bunkering it
of course
sensibly
it
and stuff. And I mean, this year, I guess, if it was, we're both looking at the map on the wall. I mean, did we have much rough for the Open this year? It could have been a lot worse.
Well, absolutely. But then, you know, it's all trampled down because you've got 50,000 spectators moving through every day. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have rough. Don't get me wrong. Of course you should. And the fairway should be an appropriate width and an appropriate area relevant to the amount of resource that club has. I would never, ever suggest that if you've got a course with, you know, managed by one guy or three or four guys, that you should end up with 20 hectares of fairway. I mean, that's just stupid. Of course you shouldn't do that. You've got to find the balancing point that it works for the resources on each club, and that differs at every single golf course in the country. However, all I'm saying is, from an architecture point of view, it should work if you didn't have any. If you didn't have any,
you would bunker it properly.
Because it's bunkered properly. And that's the key. So yeah, I'm sure that we'll get the right balance as everywhere else should try to. But I think that should be a fundamental philosophy.
Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting had you had that land and never known the routing, what you would have done yourself with it. You know, but that's probably for another podcast. Had you never seen any of that? You know,
we were going to keep
thing.
This podcast brief, so that would definitely ruin that one.
I've had quite a few messages asking about the Addington from some people really interested in it. I was lucky enough to go down. Friend Ryan Nodes invited us down at the end of the summer to play, and the time before that I visited and played with Ryan, I hadn't done half the work. Kerr Rowan, top bloke, one of my oldest friends in greenkeeping because we did college together. Leaving there to head on to Kilmarnock Barassi, where his mum was a stewardess. I mean, Kerr used to spend weekends down there, so good luck, Kerr, starting off that new job. Top bloke, done a great job at the Addington, and they're ready to take their new course manager on. Wish him all the best. And Jesus, how good that bit is now is unbelievable. I mean, when we're talking about tree clearance, 80%, how many, what have they taken out? Do you have a figure?
I don't off the top of my head, but I wouldn't be surprised if it were that.
I mean, you can see the whole London skyline from Ealing. You can see the Wembley arches. You can see right the way through the Shard.
Yeah.
Into Canary Wharf.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's unreal. And this is where, when we're talking about green trees from an agronomy point of view, we're obviously talking about shading, light, air movement, drainage. And then we're obviously looking from another, for the architecture point of view, is like, I'm a big view person, I love views. They've revealed bridges there by taking away trees.
Yeah. So anyone who hasn't listened to the episode that we did pretty early doors in the podcast, it must be three or four.
Yeah, he was one
something.
Of our kind of early ones, Ryan.
Ryan, his family own the Addington. They own a few golf courses, and it was only when Ryan was really getting into the architecture and indulging that passion that he had, when he realized that the Addington was not your everyday golf course. It was a special, special place. And it really is. The land movement there is extraordinary. And a lot of golf courses that we go to that have really great architectural history, that, you know, might be a Colt or a Simpson, or in this case, Abercrombie, it could be Fowler, it could be McKenzie, you know, one of these really great guys from history who knew what they were doing, who knew what they wanted to achieve, who had different ways of making people think, but making people think was always the objective. Well, that's as relevant now as ever it was. Now, of course, the game is very different to how it was 100 years ago. The equipment, the technology, the demands, the fact that we expect to play golf almost 365 days a year, whereas back then it might not have been the case. The fact that so many people want to play golf, the requirements on maintaining the golf course have just gone through the bloody stratosphere. It's so hard, and that's why I have so much respect for you and all the guys in the industry, Bledge, because we wouldn't have golf courses if we don't have green keepers. But fundamentally, that golf course has changed architecturally very, very little, less than almost anywhere else. And what had changed was the mowing lines, the bunkers, the not the locations of them, but how they were presented, the green shapes, and the vegetation across the site. Unbelievable. It just shows, you know, it's the old thing. If you've got trees to start with, and there were a few trees, but it was a heathland site. Mm-hmm. It was an open heath. If you were to think of, I don't know, Hankley Common or Walton Heath or somewhere that was predominantly a few trees, but mainly heather and long views. Well, the Addington had more undulation than almost anywhere else, but that's how it sort of was. And over time, for very good reasons, for well-intentioned reasons, the owners, because it was privately owned rather than being a club owned by its members. So over time, it was preserved and respected, but without that knowledge that you've actually got to take away quite a lot of trees, probably 3 or 4% of all of the trees on a site, you've really got to take them away every year just to stand still. And some people struggle to get their heads around that, because you know, you could have 1,000 trees on the site, you could have 10,000 trees on the site, you can end up with bloody more than that. But if you've got 10,000 trees on a site and someone says you've got to take away 300 or 400 of them every year just to remain static, how the hell does that work? But it's true, you know, they self-seed, they grow by that percentage, and the real issue then is if you leave it long enough, that's a compounding, you know, that's compound interest. That's not interest, that's compound interest. So it means that every period of time they double and they double again, and then you end up with this exponential growth. So playing widths that were 100 yards or corridors that were over 100 yards wide end up becoming 20 yards wide.
I mean, it's pushed significantly far back now, isn't it, really?
Exactly.
Ripping out below the trees, there's heather coming through.
And you don't just rip out the trees for the sake of ripping out the trees. You can go and identify which have the best ecological value, you know, where are the beautiful Scots pines, which are the scrubby dead rubbish that has died a long time ago and is serving no purpose for biodiversity or ecology or agronomy or anything at all. But fundamentally, Frank, my colleague, and Alistair Beggs, I would encourage anyone who hasn't listened to the Cookie Jar podcast with Alistair recently, although I'm sure that everyone listening to this absolutely would have already listened to that podcast.
Great podcast. That's one of the best podcasts I've heard for a long time. I think the Ali Beggs one is amazing for people trying to kind of get their heads around simple agronomy and understand it. If every Greens chairman listened to that, then we'd be in a better place.
Well, that was recorded on a day where Frank and Ali together did a presentation to the members at Blackwell. And the bottom line there, a lot of trees have come out from Blackwell compared to 10, 15 years ago when Frank, my colleague, started working there. But Alistair basically stood up and said, look, you know, we're entering this world where by the end of this decade, and he talks about this on the pod, at the end of this decade, you're not going to have those herbicides and germinicides and all of the things that we were talking about earlier, Bledge, to help contrive an environment that allows grasses to survive in a less than ideal landscape. So you're almost going to have to go back to basics. You're going to have to rely on light and airflow, and you know, he talked about how if in the morning when the sun is weak in winter, and if you can't burn that dew off with the sun because it's in shade all day, then all you're doing is creating an environment for disease to flourish. And he said, we're not going to have the controls that we have at the moment or have enjoyed historically to be able to get by. We're going to have to do that. We're going to have to strip out. And Alistair said, he stood up and said, 65% of the trees have got to go. And members are just, it's, oh my God, you know, it's going to be a barren, post-apocalyptic landscape, and the reality is, it's not. It's going to, yes, there's going to be more space and light, and that has massive impact for the architecture, but clearly it also has big impact for the agronomy. It can enhance the ecology of a site if you end up with trees that are native, that can flourish, that can provide those habitats, because they don't have to compete against rubbish, non-indigenous rubbish, strangling them and competing for nutrients and light and all the rest of it. Then you probably can end up with a site that can survive in the future in this very different world that we are moving towards, but also plays better, looks better. And I think the Addington will end up being the poster child for it. And it will make a lot of golf courses in and around Surrey, in Britain in general, I think, sit up, take note, and say, oh Christ, you know, this is unbelievable.
It's amazing what they've done there, and huge kudos to Ryan and his family for having that vision. I mean, Ryan is a pet with a badger, you know, we've said that
Ryan
before.
Is a force of nature. It needs a Ryan.
Yeah, we should all be more Ryan, shouldn't we, really?
Well, and the world would be
mental if
we
were all like Ryan.
Yeah,
he's a class guy. We love him, but he's great. But I mean, it's looking, technology is great. It's done loads of stuff for greenkeeping, but they weren't wrong all these years ago when we're talking about getting the basics right. You know, light flow, air flow, good drainage, sensible nutrition, sensible irrigation. All these basics.
I was
make
rereading
for
an
good
essay.
Golf course.
I dropped off a book for our green chairman at Hoylake, who incoming green chairman, who is, you know, wants to read and learn as much as possible on the subject matter. Quite rightly, you know, we're always, I think every Greens chairman, every Green committee member out in the country should, they don't have to become the expert. That's why you have the likes of Bledge and all the course managers out there, or you have an Alistair Beggs, or even you have an architect like Al Firm or some of the others out there. Because that's what we do. We trade off being the experts in those subject matters. But I do think it's very important that you have as well-rounded knowledge as possible. And Chris is absolutely of that mould. He wants to learn as much as he can so that he can support you, Bledge, as best as possible. Yep. And I dropped off an old book on sort of strategic design, and in it there was an essay Tom Simpson, my favourite architect, had written on maintenance practices, and he talked about all of the things that Alistair had stood up. Alistair, one of the leading agronomists in the country, stood up at Blackwell 3-4 weeks ago, and there were so many things in Simpson's essay from 120 years ago that Alistair had been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all still relevant. It is, you know, you can mix your modern technologies and everything that comes with that with all your old school stuff blends beautifully together. Yeah, we should all take heed of that. Definitely. It's a great podcast, and yeah.
Well, we'll get Alistair on ours. He's promised us that he'll be coming on, and we can do some, maybe even it's a few, Bledge, and we do some deeper dives. And if that was the gateway drug into agronomy for lots of people, this can be the,
yeah, definitely,
this can be the class A.
He said it'll come on. Yeah, I mean, this kind of leads on to a couple of other stuff that, I mean, I've done a couple of course visits recently. We took the team up to Royal Birkdale to have a look at all the work they're doing up there. Unbelievable. I mean, if you all look on Instagram and look at the stuff they're doing, Ben in the office up there does a great job of his drone flying. That is not Sean flying that drone, before anyone thinks that. Certainly wouldn't be. Sean's been working 24/7 up there.
It's so impressive how quickly that's coming together.
I'll have it all done before Christmas, probably. All the main kind of turf and stuff, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, fifth hole, pushing the trees right out to the right, drivable par 4, complete new redesign, the green and the surrounds, drivable par 4 now, is that right? Pretty cool. Tom McKenzie doing the architecture up there, top bloke. And then 7, raising the green out of the water table, keeping the donut bunker, awesome. Not using, is it 14, the par 3 downhill?
Yeah, 14 is the par 3 that they're
so, I mean,
off.
Absolute nightmare for the Open, trying to get people back and forward through there to the range. Something had happened to happen there. creating a new greenaway up on 15 up in the corner, big long par 5, moving the fairway over to the right. Par 3 coming back with the backdrop of the clubhouse. And it's a long par 3. I think it's about 245 or something like that. So it's going to be a run-up job, which we love, you know. The way that they've shaped the surround is to gather balls and punt it up the green, I think. I think that's pretty much it. But loads of tuning work and, yeah, it's very impressive. It really is. So watch this space. But go and have a look at that if you guys get time.
It's interesting, isn't it, how there are different ways of skinning a cat when it comes to doing the work. And I do think we should make that point. I think Birkdale have exemplified perfectly how it can be done in a very, very short order of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And clearly they have a pretty hard deadline of 2026 with the Open Championship going there to make sure everything's done and dusted. So it's obvious that they need to get it done as quickly as possible.
All the greens are laid, I'm pretty sure.
And that's unbelievable. How many people did they have working on the project?
I counted like 9 diggers when I was up there. They had a team of about 5 or 6 people laying outside Sean's staff. Sean's staff still doing all their normal work as well. So Golf Link Evolve, which is EC Mahoney's team, which are the guys that do the same work here. Brilliant, brilliant group.
Yeah, they built the new par 3 here, didn't they? Well, it's the point that I'd just like to quickly make is that is one end of the spectrum, of course, of how you can make changes. It's the old adage, you know, you've got quality, time and money as the three levers. And let's assume that we always want the quality to be as good as possible. Well, if you need it to be done very quickly, then it's going to cost more money. It's more people. It's more resources. It's done in a very, very quick and efficient way, as they're doing at Birkdale so impressively. But it needn't be the only way of doing it. You know, I think it's important to make that point that the courses out there, a lot of them that we might work with, and courses that are looking to make changes to really, really make a material difference to the quality of their golf course. You know, they might look at that and go, oh God, we can never afford to do that. We don't have the resource. We don't have the time. We don't have the number of green staff available to us. Well, I'd just say to those guys, there are other ways of doing it, Pledge, aren't there? I remember you telling me how you grew in the 16th fairway at Dion, I think the third fairway as well, you were saying.
Yes, we built a new third fairway, yeah.
Doing that out of cores taken, and yes, it takes a bit longer, but you can throw it down with cores and seed. You don't have to take a green out of play or a fairway out of play by stripping turf and relaying it. There are other ways you can do it, especially if you are building new greens out of play.
Yes,
and that's something that
exactly
we often sort of look at. There are places where if we are making changes to a routing, the green can be built then and take its time to grow in, because you can carry on playing the 18 holes as they are at the moment, build the new holes that will then facilitate further changes.
Mm-hmm.
That green doesn't have to be built in the depths of winter, when perhaps it's a parkland site where you don't really want to be getting heavy machinery around a site because of all the damage it can create. But, you know, you can do it in the middle of summer where you've got more time. Then you can core it and grow it in from the autumn perhaps. And then by the time that it's had a longer point to mature, it can being of a really high standard by the time you then make the change and bring it into play, and it might be 18 months later. Now obviously that's not an option at Birkdale, but it often is elsewhere.
Well, they'll have 2.5 summers really, won't they? If they can open these next summer, they'll have next summer, the summer after, and then half before they open, there'll be plenty settled in by then, you know. I think you'll tell they're new, but I don't think you'll really tell.
Absolutely. Yeah. But you can end up doing something if you were to do it in that way, and it must be a third or a third of the cost of there's a range of doing things. So I just think that's an important point to make for any course out there who's thinking, well, we can never afford to do what Birkdale have done. There's a broad spectrum of ways you can do it, and it's getting
the biggest cost comes down to timing with that. Well, a job like that, it's huge. It's very impressive up there, it really is. It's great for my team to get up and see it as well. You know, I get a bit of jealousy when I see this because I love these big projects. But it was maybe it is time we kind of chilled out a little bit. But another great thing we did, and it's not always about architecture that we need to make improvements to the course here. So we did a really good trip up to the Greens Chairman, up to Royal Lytham, where they are sorting out their drainage.
I love Lytham.
It's one of my favourites as
such
well.
Such an underrated, you know, for the open rotor, I think it gets quite underrated.
I think it's a ridiculously good golf course. And the course manager up there, Paul, is one of the best. A lot of respect for him and all the work that he's done. I've never played it when there's been a blade of grass out of place. The place looks stunning when we're up there. There's so much sheep's fescue everywhere, and the greens didn't have a blemish on them, you know. And he's doing all that work alongside doing hole improvements with First Golf, Marcus Terry, up there. They're moving some stuff about. But the most interesting thing was the dewatering. So getting rid of the water table, pumping the water table out, so they can put drains in. I mean, you're even talking about draining on level or draining uphill to get rid of water.
Which is something historically that Lytham have suffered with, isn't it?
Well, there was a bunker that he showed us that he said it's been wet for 100 years.
Yeah.
Bone dry.
Pretty flat site, you know, great ground movement, but on a macro level, it's a relatively level site, isn't it? And then obviously cut off from the sea with the railway line and then the houses and the urban space between the golf course and the water. So it's inevitable that it's going to have more water on it than most.
I'm sure everyone's water table is really high just now. Ours is a foot under the ground, and it's coming up. I mean, our bunkers on open 18 have been full to the brim with water all winter. You cannot get rid of it. We've dug it out to exchange the sand. We've dug it out to see if there's a permeable layer we could hit, but it's not. It's a perch water table. It's the highest part of the course, as you know by your studies. And in the lowest part of the course, the water table is actually lower. So it's all over the shop, but you can drain water tables. So this is one thing we're going to have to look to the future. I mean, I think our whole range needs drained. There's a lot of, it's the least glamorous spend, but it would give us the most amount of improvement. And the whole point of Lynx Golf Course is that it's sustainable and playable all year round. And our golf course sadly isn't fully playable just now because we've got 20 or 30 bunkers that are flooded.
And we all saw how well the golf course stood up to the deluge this year.
Yeah, I mean, it drains unbelievably well, but when the water table comes up, it's screwed.
So anyone out there who's got a golf course under a bit of water, if you want to point your greens chairman or your members who are giving you a bit of flack for it to the fact that you had one of the best draining golf courses in the country, full stop, under the glare of millions and millions of people watching the Open Championship on Sunday. What was the rainfall on that Sunday?
We had 33 mil of rain.
So you had 33 mil of rain over one day.
Two puddles.
And you had two tiny puddles. You had all these guys.
One of which was a problem that we have fixed now because it was standard material underneath it, which we've dug out and exchanged, and it's dry now. So
you have one of the courses that stood up to that volume of rainfall better than almost anywhere else could have done. And even you, Bledger, are struggling to bring the water table down in the middle of winter because of the volume of water
that's
fallen.
You just can't do it. Unless we do the dewater and put the drains in and spend a six-figure sum. But that's going to have to happen in the future, you know. But it's something we're going to start looking into now, now that the Open's gone with. It's a process. Everything happens. I mean, I've only been here 2 years, but it's the next thing to tick off, I think. You know, our irrigation system is working really well still, so we can kind of shelf that probably for a few more years and hope it lasts a bit longer. But before then, we need to sort this out. I mean, the surfaces are completely dry.
Yeah.
We don't have wet fairways. I mean, the place is bone dry all the way through, but it's just these bunkers.
Do you find that there are maybe some lower points? And you're right, there's not many of the actual sorts of cut playing surfaces that I can think of that would puddle, maybe around the six green or left of seven, or you know, that they're historically the areas that might get a little bit of water in very, very extreme circumstances of rainfall. How do you find those slightly damper areas in terms of the agronomy and the grasses that you end up with? Does it sort of reduce your ability to get the finer grasses you're after?
I mean, it's quite evident there's a touch more ryegrass in it. I was very draining the first member's first fairway, and on the corner, that was the Vetter Dream was pulling up a puddle, and it didn't look wet at all. Yet the whole range is wet. So we need to ask ourselves the questions: why are all the fairways fine, but the range is wet? You know, I mean, it can't possibly be that there's just less sand under there. You know, it's weird. It doesn't look lower. So
do you think perhaps because that gets cut in a different way, it's a bit thatchier, or
it could
a bit...
be it could quite be down to the fact that we've had all them tents on it all summer, you know, and it's not been vetted drained for a while. We've done all that again, so it's a lot of work to be done still. There's a lot of work, but we're starting with it, so
it's looking great. And that's the point, you know, these are living organisms at the end of the day, aren't they? Mm. Like, you don't get them finished. You are just constantly trying that battle with nature to get them as good as possible on it.
Yeah.
And with the good, fantastic,
correct amount of funding and thought and team thought behind it, working with Gordon Howitt from the R&A to kind of come up with a plan. So we'll see where that goes.
Well, Bledge, we're an hour in. There's still loads that we should talk about. Why don't we call this a day for now? And
We'll do a part two
this week. We'll get this one out there. And then it's been great doing the podcast again, chatting with my mate. So I think we should do a little bit more of it. There's still more that we'd like to talk about. And we'll do one more of these reintroduction to series two episodes before we then get going with our guests proper.
Excellent. And then that would give us a good chance to discuss potential guests that we could have on next time.
And also, because we will get this one up and on the airwaves before we record the second part of it, perhaps give you guys who have persevered and listened all the way through this episode, why don't you fire us some suggestions, things you'd like to talk about, if they've got any questions that you'd like to ask Bledge or me, but mainly Bledge, then we could probably incorporate them into the second half of this this series two kicker offer.
Excellent. Nice talking to you again, Sam.
And you, mate. Right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Speak to you very soon.